So tonight, my talk is based on a particular sutta called the Sitseto Kila Sutta. The translation is much longer. It's called The Wilderness of Doubt and the Shackles of Craving. Yeah. But it's like, here's two of the five kalesas that are so difficult to work with. And the Buddha goes into a great deal of detail about them, and then goes beyond that. I want to read a little bit of the Sangha first, the Satsutta first. Bhikkhus, that's us, right? That any bhikkhu has not abandoned five wildernesses in the heart and not severed the five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in the Dhamma discipline, that is impossible. In other words, here's something that you need to do to progress in the practice. What bhikkhus are the five wildernesses in the heart that he has not abandoned? Here a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the teacher. And thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance and striving. And his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, persistence and understanding, that is the first wilderness in the heart that is not abandoned. Again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain and undecided and confident about the Dhamma. That's number two. Again, the bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided and unconfident about the Sangha. Again, the bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the training. Again, a bhikkhu is angry and displeased with his companions in the holy life, resentful and callous towards them. So here's five obstacles, five forms of this obstacle called doubt. And it's interesting Buddha used the term wilderness. So I actually looked up wilderness in the dictionary. A neglected or abandoned area. Because we think of wilderness as like nature, isn't it wonderful? But actually, that's the actual translation, a neglected or abandoned area. So something that isn't being put to use in the sense of like something. It isn't cultivated, no one's doing anything, it's just there. And it has this, other sensation in the Pali, which is like rigidity of mind, rubbish, a stump in the mind. So like there's something that's like a stump, it's like something that blocks you, right? You bump into it and you can't get past it. Think how big the stump is, of course. But then in the classical similes where the Buddha's talking about doubt, when he's talking about doubt in the context of the five kalesas, the classical image is a cloudy pond where the water is turbid, where the water is stirred up. So when you're in doubt, you can't see clearly, is the idea. But let's look at these, the five things that we might be doubtful of. It's an interesting list, right? First one is doubting the teacher. That doesn't mean me, by the way, that means the Buddha. I suppose it might mean me too, in the smaller sense, but it's important that we don't doubt the teacher. But at the same time, it is also important to remember that it's wise to question what the teacher is saying. It's not like, when we doubt the teacher, it's like we're saying, oh, this guy's just full of beans, or this woman doesn't know what she's talking about. These teachers are just like nonsense. It's like rejecting them. And that's different from questioning. It's quite wise, the question of like, what does that mean? Why does it have to be this way instead of that way? And sort of digging into things that the teacher says, that's useful, but that's different from doubt, which is a rejection. Right? And doubting the Dhamma, number two, the teachings of the Buddha. And the Dhamma is like this incredible roadmap, right? And we've undertaken the practices because we want to go in a certain direction towards enlightenment. If we doubt the teachings, the signposts pointing the way, we may fall off course. We may not. We may end up going off in some wild direction, right? I mean, the words that the sutta uses is just interesting. That it is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident, right? And that means you won't incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. If you're in doubt, you're not going to be very enthusiastic about actually following through and with the practice, what the teacher is saying and what the Dhamma is saying. We just wander around in doubt. We're lost in the wilderness. Then there's doubting the Sangha. And this has got more, it's got a couple of different meanings. First one is, it can mean doubting the importance of Sangha, of being supported by others. You know, there's that sort of, I can do this by myself, I don't need anybody, sort of vibe that can, in our culture, is pretty strong, you know.
You know, man's got to do what a man's got to do,
that sort of stuff, right? Really gets in the way. And this, actually, there's this something in the Samyutta Nikaya that I always keep referring to because I like this bit so much. This is Sariputta approaching the Buddha. And there's another one where Ananda is approaching the Buddha. So Ananda is both the nephew's, because the Buddha's nephew, and also has been his attendant for like 20 years at this point, right? Venerable Sir, this is Ananda, this is half the holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. And the Buddha answers, not so, Ananda, not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. And then later on, and there's another version of this, where it's Sariputta, who is the principal disciple of the Buddha, one of the original five, who was his like right-hand man in a lot of ways. Essentially the same story. So what the Buddha is saying is, you can't do this alone. It isn't something you can possibly do alone. You need good friendship, good companionship. You need to practice with others. Sangha is really powerful. But then it can also mean, doubting the Sangha can also mean you're sort of like, that the sort of looking at the people in the Sangha and going, yeah, these people aren't serious. They're not really sincere. They're, judging them in some way. When I first came to Boulder, now, going back 20 years, and I first started going to David's, I guess at that point it was a Tuesday night Sangha that he had at the Universalist Church. And I was so full of judgment. And because, I mean, I had been practicing, these long retreats in silence. And I was really like, well, silence is really important. How can you? And David would have a sitting period. And then everybody would get up and talk and chat. And it would be like this big social occasion. And I was like, no, you can't. I was just like, I thought this was like absolutely improper. And I actually stopped going for a couple of years. I actually walked away from the whole thing, and then I eventually, you know, realized how stupid I was, essentially, and went back and started being with David again. That was, so it took me a couple of years. I actually was really strongly, you know, sort of, because I was so thinking I was right, and you're supposed to be silent, and how can all these people just be hanging around and chanting and chatting and making this into a big social occasion? So it's just doubt in the Sangha. But I didn't see it that way. I thought I was very self-righteous about this. Like, I've got it right. The interesting thing about these first three, doubting the teacher, doubting the Dhamma, doubting the Sangha, what did we take refuge in? The Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So how can you doubt what you take refuge in? So this is the Buddha coming back to that theme from a very different angle, but talking about how important it is when we take refuge to actually believe what we're saying, that this, that those three things constitute a safe place for our heart mind. And then he goes on. This is the fourth form of doubt. Is doubting the training. So for monastics, this would mean doubting the strict rules that a monastic must follow, and that these rules are somehow useful. You know, now, I forget what the number is. It's 137 or 149, some number, like a huge number of things that monastics had to follow. To follow the Vinaya was like this very strict set of rules. It had a lot to do with things like, you know, not storing food and not carrying food more than 5 miles, and you know, not keeping your leftovers, and all these other things. And how you what kind of robe you had, and how you tied your robe. It was just like really, really strict. And the understanding I have is that the Buddha had this rather strict set of rules to sort of weed out the people who were kind of lazy. You know, if you could follow these, it also made you certain that you had to be incredibly mindful to follow all these rules. I mean, just to be able to follow the rules, you have to be very mindful of what all the rules were, and, oh no, I'm tying my robe, I have to tie it this way, not that way. And there's a parallel of this in Zen, where Zen has this whole very formal way of doing everything, right? How you get your food, how you, you know, what you chant when you do, how you bow to this and how you bow to that, and it gives continuity of practice. Having this form that's quite strict is actually one way to create continuity of practice, and that's, I think, why it's such a big deal in Zen, because other than the form, the practice is quite simple. You know, but the form is very serious in Zen practice. I mean, it's very, like, precise. And for people who like that sort of thing, it's a perfect way to practice. I tried it out. It didn't really suit me. I was a sort of, you know, free-form kind of guy, maybe. I don't know. But what does it mean for us? We're not monastics, we're householders. What does it mean for us? Well, first of all, it's still the five precepts that the householders take. That is still the training. You know? And if we start doubting the five precepts, then we're going to be lost. Because the five precepts are what keep us leading a wholesome life, an ethical life, and the precepts are about exactly that. The pointers to, here's how you can lead a wholesome and ethical life as a householder. And so if we doubt that that makes it worthwhile or make any sense, it's once again, we're going to go off the rails, I suppose, would be one way to put it. It also means, because there are so many different forms of practice, it could be that what we're doubting, when we talk about doubting the training as householders, is just doubting this form. Oh, this Theravada form of just paying attention to the breath and or doing this metta stuff. It just isn't good. It's not strong enough. It's not fierce enough. I want to have sort of that warrior mentality of Zen, or I want to have the more worshipful forms that you see in some of the Tibetan forms. I think it's really skillful to doubt that at the beginning. I mean, to look at different forms of practice. But at some point, you need to choose a particular form that suits you, and then stick with it. Someone asked, I was on a retreat with Joseph Goldstein, and he had a question period, and someone asked him, because Joseph has actually taught about other forms of practice other than the mindfulness form of Theravada form. And they said, well, when is that useful? This was sort of the question. And Joseph had this great answer. He said, well, you have to find one form, and then you sort of stick with it for 10 years of diligent practice. And once you have 10 years of diligent practice in that form, then you'll be really grounded in that form. And then it can be skillful to look at these other forms, so you can sort of compare and contrast, and there's things that are in these forms that are quite valuable, but you're so grounded in the form that you chose that you're not going to sort of get confused. You could go to a different Buddhist group in Boulder every night of the week, or probably the month, and get 37 different views of what the Buddha taught and how to practice it. And you'd end up being totally confused. But if you're grounded in one particular form, then it's much more likely, if you start looking at other forms, that you'll stay grounded in the tradition and practice you've already spent 10 years developing. So that's the fourth form of doubt. And then doubting the companions. And this is less about doubt in some senses, and more about judging others. So it's just doubting others, that they aren't diligent or serious or enough or holy enough. And the problem with this is this leads to a lot of ill will and arguments. Like, what's wrong with you, Joe? You're not sitting the right way, and you're not serious about the practice, and you don't come to Sangha all the time, and blah, blah, blah. All the things that people get caught up in, pointing and blaming others. And it comes from this sense of self-righteousness often. I'm real serious about this, and you people just aren't so serious. You slackers, or you're doing it the wrong way. Talk about the source of chaos in the Sangha. And really this comes down to the idea of the problems with comparing, which is, I don't have the sutta here, but it's another line where the Buddha says essentially, if you end up comparing yourself to anything or anyone, whether you think you're better than, worse than, or even equal to, this is going to lead you into error, because it basically, by as soon as you start comparing, you create a sense of separation. You create a sense of me and not me, me and who I'm comparing to. And you're losing the truth of the fact that we're all connected. And so comparing is a big issue. It's sometimes called conceit. It's a word that you'll see in Buddhist literature. It's a big issue in our culture as well, because we're always, we get caught up in comparing, and if we think we're right and they're wrong, then, you know, at the extremes, well, that means we can do things to those people because they're wrong and we're right, and we just got to straighten them out, and we have to maybe force them to be straightened out, and blah, 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 you know, so that sort of level. There's another sort of layer of this, however. If you're doubting the companions, it also sort of another side of that same coin is doubting yourself. Doubting, you know, I'm not holy enough. I'm not good enough. I can't understand these teachings. I can't do this. This sort of fits under doubting the companions, I think, because you're one of the companions. Now you're doubting yourself. And this is something you have to really watch for, because the thing about doubt, and now we're talking in the broader sense of any of these forms of doubt, is they have this sort of, at the mental level, this sort of logical mental story attached to them. You know, it's like, well, of course, you know. Whenever you hear yourself say, of course, or something like maybe it's always been that way, it's like someone's waving the yellow warning flag in your brain, right? It's like those are the times when you're going, you think you've got it all figured out, which we never do. And also, we're comparing and thinking, you know, that it should be a certain way, or I should be a certain way, or I can't do this, I'm not capable. And if you're caught in doubt, it just wears you out. And it also makes you, like as the Buddha says, it doesn't make you very diligent, because you're not, it's pretty hard to be diligent in your practice and be caught in doubt at the same time. Because you're just wound up, you know, in the mind, ranting to yourself about, oh, I can't do this, what's wrong with me? Or I can do this, but those people can't, which is, you know, the other variety. And it just wears you out. I had a month-long retreat where the main feature of the retreat was doubt. I mean, for like most of the time, I was caught in doubt. And this is, you know, after many long retreats where I had totally wonderful retreats and full of calm and joy, and then, you know, here was this retreat, and it was just like, I got to a certain point in the practice, and my teacher was trying to sort of push me over into the next layer of it or something like that. I don't know. It's hard to describe. And I just got into this whole space of, I can't do this. There's something wrong with me. I don't get it. Maybe this practice isn't right for me. Maybe this teacher who I've been studying with for 10 years and I was really totally in my heart revered, maybe he's just no good. Maybe I've been fooled and led astray. I mean, it's like the nonsense that doubt creates in your mind is really powerful stuff. Because you have all these, like, you create all these stories about it that make it sound so rational and reasonable. It was probably one of the most painful periods of my practice life. At the same time, I really learned a lot about doubt. I really could see how, because at the same time I was in doubt, I could see at some times when there would be clarity in my mind, oh, this is just doubt. And I could see it in all the forms it took, and it was like watching the whole story lay out, and then I'd be caught up in the whirlwind again. In the classical teachings, the antidote to doubt, the main antidotes to doubts are to study the Dhamma more. You get a clear understanding of the teachings, so they will dispel your doubt. And the other one is, go back to your original intention for practicing and reaffirm that. Oh, here we are, back to right intention, the second step on the Eightfold Path. Like, forget about all those things further down the path. Just go back to your intention. Go back to the beginning of the practice. Beginner's mind ideas, almost. And just look at what your intention was, and still is. And clarify that intention. And this clarifying your intention will often dissipate the doubt. These are the classical ways to work with it. So that's doubt. Then we get to the second section. What, bhikkhus, are the five shackles in the heart that he has not severed? Here a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, fever, craving for sensual pleasure, and thus his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind is not inclined to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, this is the first shackle of the heart that has to be severed. Again, a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, thirst, craving for a body. Again, a bhikkhu is not free from lust, desire, affection, for craving for form. Again, a bhikkhu eats as much as he likes until his belly is full and indulges in the pleasures of sleeping, lolling, and drowsing. I love the language here. And again, a bhikkhu lives the holy life aspiring to some order of gods. Thus, by this virtue or observance or asceticism or holy life, thou shalt become a great god or some lesser god. In other words, I'm going to be really important. So there's the five shackles of the heart. First of these, sensual pleasure. This is Joseph Goldstein. This is from the very first book he wrote, The Experience of Insight, which was actually, this is just the text of a lot of his talks and teachings during the first time he taught a 30-day retreat. Or maybe not the first time, but very early on in his teaching. He's talking about the first of these enemies or hindrances is sense desire, lusting after sense pleasure, grasping at sense objects. It keeps the mind looking outwards, searching after this object or that, in an agitated and unbalanced way. It is the very nature of sense desires that they can never be satisfied. There is no end to seeking. We enjoy a pleasurable object. It arises and disappears, as do all phenomena, and we are left with the same unsatiated desire for more gratification. Until we deal with that kind of grasping in the mind, we remain always unfulfilled, always seeking a new pleasure, a new delight. It can be desire for beautiful sights, beautiful sounds, smells, tastes, pleasant sensations in the body, or fascinating ideas. I have to watch for. Attachment to these objects strengthens the greed factor, and it is precisely greed in the mind, this clinging and grasping, which keeps us bound. That's the word bound, and here it's talking about the five shackles of the heart. By the way, I looked up shackles, and this is like fetters connected together by a chain, used to fasten a prisoner's wrists or ankles together. In other words, you're really tied up. And then in the sense of the translation from the Pali, another translation is clenching the mind like a fist. You ever clench your mind like a fist around really, I need to have that. I need to have it right now. Whether it's a tub of Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, or a perfect partner, or a new job, or whatever, we clench around. There's a vast variety. basically, as long as we keep believing, as long as we keep believing that somehow or other I can find the right combination of stuff that'll make me happy. If I can just get it all together and have just this, you know, the right job and the right partner and the right house and the right car and the right this and the right that, and, you know, the list is endless, right? Then somehow I'll be happy. I'll no longer suffer from unhappiness. And here's the interesting truth. At any one moment when we crave something and then we actually get it, when we actually get what we're craving for, whether it's like a tub of ice cream or a new car or whatever, the moment we actually get it, the mind goes quite still because we've been wanting and wanting and wanting, and then we got it. And the mind just goes, and so, and that makes us believe that getting that thing is what made us happy. But actually what made us happy is we stopped wanting. The mind went still briefly. But then we just start wanting the next thing. As Joseph points out, it's endless. It's almost like we've got to have one more thing. And even if we could somehow magically get all the right things all together somehow so that our life was, quote, perfect, things change. Moment to moment, things are changing. We know that. And so even if I got everything that could be totally wonderful all at once, almost immediately something's going to change and I won't have everything anymore. And now I'll want something more to make it perfect again. It's endless. It's an endless game of wanting. And craving for maintaining a body. We somehow think that this body is exempt from the laws of nature. You know, that somehow or other everything else is impermanent, but this body isn't. It's like this body's magic somehow. It isn't going to age. It isn't going to get old. It isn't going to decay. It isn't going to become impermanent. And this is like a really deeply held craving that we have to see really clearly. I had an experience on one of my retreats back there. I had this job. Like, on retreat, people have little things they do. I was ringing the bell for the 2 o'clock sit, right? A big deal. But I've been on the retreat for quite a while. I was quite focused and concentrated. So when I rang the bell, it was like I was very mindful while I was ringing the bell. So I'd pick up the hammer and I'd feel the hammer in my hand, and then I'd feel my arm swinging back and my arm swinging forward and feel the hammer hit the bell and hear the sound of the bell, and I was just like totally mindful of the whole thing. And then I do this like 6 or 7 times, but you do it and ring the bell. And it was just like very precise, and I was very like just like clear and focused. And it wasn't like, I almost wasn't aware that this was going on. It was just that's where I was in my practice at that time. And then I hung up the hammer. And I turned to start walking away from the bell to go into the hall, and this thought arose in my mind. You may never ring that bell again. And it was this sort of this little pause. And then in my mind I went, no, there's still a couple of days left on the retreat. I'll ring it tomorrow. And then there's another little pause, and it was like, oh. Actually, you may never ring that bell again. You don't know. I didn't have a clue that I'd actually be there in physical form tomorrow to ring the bell. This is what they mean by impermanence. And it was funny because, you know, I'd been studying and practicing all for a while at this point, and maybe on several long retreats. And it was like, I understood what impermanence was, right? Mentally, I had it all figured out. But it was like, yeah, this body's impermanent, but not for another 20 years or so. It wasn't like, well, you know, you never know whether it's going to be, what's going to happen tomorrow. You really don't have any clue. None of us do, ever. And it was like a wake-up call for me just to see how I think I was permanent. So that's craving for maintaining the body. Then craving for form. I had to sort of look at some of the commentaries on this. And this is a craving for other bodies, rather than this body. You know? Not necessarily just physical tactile connection, but desire just to look at other bodies, or always wanting something to be permanent. Not just this body, but that other body I happen to be living with right now and feel so close to. I want that to be permanent too. I crave for that body to be maintained, which is equally ridiculous. Equally ridiculous in terms of what we understand. Or it could even be a body, it could be like a car. I want my car to stay the same, never have a dent or a scratch on it. Which of course, all cars have dents and scratches on them. It's just the nature of owning a car. You know, the front suspension of my 10-year-old Subaru probably should get some attention fairly soon. But, you know, it's like, no, Mike, it's okay. You know, we keep fooling ourselves. We want things to stay the same. How about craving for eating and napping? I like this. I like how this Buddha says. Again, a bhikkhu eats as much as he likes until his belly is full and indulges in the pleasures of sleeping, lolling, and drowsing. In other words, we sometimes want to just be lazy. And I want to point to something, and this is really important. Sometimes this is exactly what we need to do. Sometimes what we need to do is just take a break and kick back and relax. But when it becomes our main form of dealing with stress in the world, all the space out, this becomes craving for. Now we want it because it's a way for us to sort of have momentary happiness. I can get a little moment. I can't have really good happiness. At least I can have this momentary happiness. It just doesn't work, but it's like gives us a little hit. Right? And then I love this last one: craving for a godlike form. Well, I cut this down to, you know, craving to be famous. In our culture, it's like we all people want their 15 minutes of fame, right? You know, craving to be someone that everybody thinks is just totally wonderful. Once again, really easy to get caught there. I have these little moments. I mean, you know, once in a while, I think, wouldn't it be great if I ended up being the teacher for some famous movie star. And then this movie star invited me to Hollywood and I'd teach in their fabulous house to all their friends. I mean, total nonsense. But it's like craving for a godlike form, right? Like, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be, you know, Sandra Bullock's Dharma teacher or something. I mean, the nonsense. And very quickly I see, like, oh, this is like total nonsense. But it's like, that's the kind of thing that arises in the mind. That's like, that's another craving, wanting to be that kind of person, like someone saying. And of course, I'd be very holy and humble while I was being famous, you know. Fat chance, right? But it's like, it's interesting how the mind catches and goes into these little places. So, in the sutta, the Buddha goes through both those lists again from the positive point of view. But then he comes to this really interesting thing. He says, bhikkhus, that any bhikkhu has abandoned these five wildernesses in the heart and severed these five shackles in the heart should come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this dharma discipline. This is possible. So in other words, if you can overcome doubt and craving, then the practice will blossom, and it'll do that because mindfulness is there. Because how do we overcome all these things? All these things that we've described are because we're mindful enough to see what they are and laugh at them, hopefully, and go, oh, but that's, I don't really need to, you know, be the Dharma teacher to a movie star or whatever. I don't really need XYZ. I can see clearly that the doubt is just some momentary arising in the mind, and with a strong intention, I don't need to believe that doubt is anything other than just some wild story in the mind. But that's all of that takes mindfulness. You have to be aware of it and see it. Then the Buddha goes on. So I notice that it's possible. We're not done yet. This is like, now we've got everything we need to have a good start, you know, which is, you know, when the Buddha talks about something called the seven factors of awakening, which is like the progressive steps you go through into deeper levels of this practice, the first one is mindfulness. Once mindfulness is established, like the, and remember, mindfulness in this sense means the mental formation of mindfulness itself has arisen, because we practiced and created the causes and conditions such that mindfulness has arisen. Then, he develops the basis for spiritual powers consisting in concentration due to zeal and determined striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to energy and determined striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to purity of mind and determined striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power consisting in concentration due to investigation and determined striving. And enthusiasm is the fifth. So now, here's five more. Now that you've got rid of the five shackles, you know, the five, you know, out of the five wildernesses and broken the five shackles, now here's five more things you need to do. Zeal, energy, purity of mind, investigation, and enthusiasm. These quite clearly parallel what are called the awakening factors in the seven factors of awakening. They're like, these are the things that sort of, you know, when we have energy, when we put in effort, and we see things arising and moving along, And we start to have deeper experiences and become more deeply concentrated, it encourages us to practice more. That's how. It's like investigation here means looking at what's arising from the point of view of the three factors, you know, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not self, and actually starting to see those. Investigating what we're experiencing, not on the level of, well, this is happening and that's happening, but seeing the underlying energies that are always the same. The consistency of those factors is always there, clearly, when we investigate. We start to see that everything is impermanent, for instance. So the first one is the one that's easiest to see. Because you see, if you just really sit still and pay attention to the mind, it's like this thing arises, it's there for a while, then it's gone. But then another thing arises, and it doesn't matter what the thing is. It's just stuff. You start to see there's just stuff that's arising, and see the pattern that underlies it. Enthusiasm. It's like getting to the point where you're practicing and you're going, wow, this is really incredible. Which happens sometimes when you're practicing too. Like there's the experience of the practice itself is just like so thrilling. Which is also something that happens in this practice. We get to that place where it's like, I just can't wait to go sit again. Enthusiasm, excitement. And then, of course, the Buddha says, a bhikkhu who thus possesses the 15 factors, so breaking the five shackles, overcoming the five wildernesses, and developing these energetic arousing factors in the mind. A bhikkhu who possesses the 15 factors, including enthusiasm, is capable of breaking out, capable of enlightenment, capable of attaining the supreme security from bondage. This is, you've laid the groundwork, you've created the causes and conditions such that moments of enlightenment will arise. And over time it becomes, so they tell me, more permanent. But even at the beginning, it's like you have these moments of like, where it's just everything is crystal clear, very powerful.
And then
he says this really interesting thing. He says, suppose there were a hen with 8, 10, or 12 eggs, which she had covered, incubated, and nurtured properly. Even though she did not wish, oh, that my chicks might pierce their shells with the points of their claws and beaks and hatch out safely, yet the chicks are capable of piercing their shells with the point of their claws and beaks and hatching out safely. So too, bhikkhu, those who possess the 15 factors have the ability to break out of our shells. The shell of smallness of thinking we're not capable. Thinking we have to have these things. Have this capability of breaking out. Not saying we will, that we have the capability, that potential, we've created the potential, we've created the possibility, which is all we can ever do. We can't make ourselves be enlightened. We can only create causes and conditions such that energy of enlightenment arises more frequently in our lives. And no one can do this for you. You have to do this all yourself. Even though it's important, like we talked about having the importance of Sangha, it's like it's important to be around other people who are trying to do this too, because it encourages you to keep going and gives you the strength of collective energy. But in the end, this is something we all have to choose and then move towards. There is a little bit of poetry I want to read, of course. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. And I'm sure you've heard me read this poem before, some of you. But it's called Lay the Armor Down. Arriving back from the fields of battle, bruised and bolder, we're beholden to no one now. Losing or winning, the reason for the war fade quickly from the memory. We've forgotten that these suits of armor are not our second skins. Smiling, we set aside the shields and swords, remove the face mask, begin to peel away the layers of weight and protection. When finally we cast our armor to the ground, it feels as if our bodies grow and straighten, swell and lengthen upwards towards the sun. We run, light and unencumbered, and stretch the stiffness from our joints. Rolling on the grass, we laugh as awkward limbs remember freedom. When at last we return to where we started, without a second glance, we know that we've outgrown the suits of armor. We won't fit inside those two tight shells again. Why would we even try? That's what the suit is all about, I think. We armor ourselves with doubt, and we armor ourselves with wanting, because it's how we think we can keep it together. If we can take off the armor, stop, walk away from the battle, take off the armor, we won't fit inside again. Why would we? That's what I have to share with you.